Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome to the program Becca Wolf. She is the co-founder of the Palestinian Solidarity Project, and she will be giving a talk titled Beyond the Rhetoric, Realities of Israeli Occupation, this Sunday, the 30th of January, at 6 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Santa Fe, presented by Another Jewish Voice. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you have an unusual background. You're a Jewish Santa Fean, you're an Israeli citizen, daughter of the musical director at Temple Beth Shalom, and your twin sister is a rabbi, and you're married to a Palestinian. You're an activist for Palestinian rights and freedom. Tell us about the path that led you in that direction.
Yeah, it sounds a lot more dramatic than I think it was. I experienced it. I grew up in Santa Fe and grew up in the Jewish community here. Originally traveled to the Middle East with the synagogue, with a Jewish youth trip when I was 17, and then didn't return to the issue, really, until I was in college in New York City during September 11th. And activism at the time around the emerging Iraq war, the Afghanistan war, and what was happening in New York City in particular was trying to bring about awareness and making the connections between what was happening in Iraq, in Afghanistan, American foreign policy, and what was happening in Israel and Palestine. And
a connection which isn't usually made.
Right. I mean, it was really difficult for people to try to move the emerging anti-war movement into an area of saying this is actually a wider issue of what is happening in the region, and that part of American foreign policy also is very closely linked to its policy on Israel. And there was a fantastic organization in New York City called Jews Against the Occupation that really took on being a Jewish voice that could be recognized as also a pro-Palestinian rights voice. And so I joined them, and in 2003 went over for the first time as an activist to the West Bank, and was there for a few weeks. And it actually happened to be a period of time where popular, nonviolent mass mobilization was reemerging, right at the end of, or towards the end of the Second Intifada, when communities were trying to protest the construction of the wall that was being built. And so I was in a couple of communities that were organizing their populaces to resist the construction of the wall and the demolition of their land. And I think that because I was plugged into that as my introduction to Palestinian rights and can really understand the physical realities of what was happening to Palestinians and in Palestinian land by the Israeli government and with American support, it was very meaningful for me and kind of inspired me to stay on that track, and I did.
I'd love to hear more about your actual experience on the ground. I mean, one of the things that happens when you talk to people who are not particularly sympathetic with Palestinians or what they're going through is they just don't know what life is like. So, for example, there you are helping to organize people who are against the wall. What were their lives like? What did you see?
You know, the majority of the Palestinian population in the West Bank is really rural. So I was in really small villages of people that had relatively large tracts of land where they had olive trees or fruit trees or whatnot. It's a really agricultural lifestyle. And so it's this very strange juxtaposition between understanding that Palestinians do live and attempt to live average lives. They go to school, they go to work, they farm land, they get up early in the morning, they come home, they take their kids home, you know, they feed them lunch, breakfast, dinner. You know, it's a really common experience in a totally bizarre and uncommon circumstance. And so you can be doing any number of those really average things and have a military invasion happening. And so, for example, in the first town that I was in Budrus, which has now become relatively well known because there's a fantastic film about it. It's a community at the time of about 900 people. And what they were doing when the wall was being built through their agricultural land was they were, the kids were all going to school for the morning, and then at the end, in the middle of the day, about 1 o'clock, the school would break and everybody would march out to the fields and to where the bulldozers were uprooting the trees and carrying signs and chanting and also trying to get in the way of the bulldozers and nonviolently block the bulldozers. And so, you know, it was eye-opening for me to understand that on the one hand, it is a really, they are so similar to the Israeli population, to American rural populations. I mean, it's not people sitting around and plotting terrorist activity, you know, it's like people sitting around and asking me for help with their English homework because they figured out that I spoke English, you know, and that kind of a thing. And then, but having to deal with really harsh realities of being under a military occupation where, and it, in some ways, had become so normalized to them that to have an international come out and say, no, it really is strange that you just couldn't go to school today because there was a military checkpoint in the middle of your town. That doesn't actually happen in most of the world, especially not, you know, in the United States, in most places. And so that was really a hard reality for me to really comprehend and also very difficult to explain to an American audience.
And when you say, hey guys, this isn't normal, how do they respond?
You know, they recognize it. I mean, the Palestinians have an amazing sense of sort of both an awareness of their situation and how important it is to international politics and, you know, geopolitical everything, but also really appreciate acknowledgement that what they are going through is not acceptable, that it's not average.
So in this village of Budrus where they were protesting, what happened?
Budrus is actually a really interesting example because it is the only example of a true success against the construction of the wall. So they demonstrated for about 3 months where they literally made it so expensive, so difficult for the Israeli military to build the wall through their land because they had to bring in hundreds and hundreds of soldiers every single day to try to keep the residents out of the way of the bulldozers so that they could continue, that in the end they gave up and built the wall for the most part on the green line rather than through the agricultural land. And so it actually has become a model for other communities that it is in fact possible through these kinds of movements to make a real difference.
What is the Green Line?
The Green Line is the 1949 Armistice Line, so it's what delineates the West Bank from Israel proper. Budrus is right on the edge of the West Bank at Israel, and so the Green Line is what is usually considered the quote-unquote border between the Palestinian territories, meaning the West Bank, and Israel.
And so building on the Green Line, while a seemingly reasonable thing to do, is not the normal practice?
Not at all. The wall is less than 20% of the wall is actually being built on the Green Line. The rest of it is being built in Palestinian territory.
And that is just 'cause we can kind of thing?
It's for a couple of reasons. One is to annex large settlement blocks, so getting the settlements on the Israeli side of the wall versus the Palestinian side. And the other is that if you overlay a map of the path of the wall with vital water sources in the West Bank, you see a very interesting commonality where they're also trying to keep as much of water sources under Israeli control as possible. Most people believe Israel has said that the wall is temporary, that it's a temporary security measure, even though the length of it is now three times the length of the Green Line. So it's much more difficult to defend if you're thinking in a military way.
It's not a straight line.
Right, exactly. It's in fact going between Palestinian villages and in some places literally cutting towns in half, going straight down the middle of a town like what it does in Bethlehem. And so the wall But Israel says that it's temporary, that it's a security measure to prevent suicide bombings, and that it will be uprooted. Most Palestinians believe that what Israel is trying to do is, like it does with so many other things, create facts on the ground, that the wall will become the border simply because it's there. And so they want to use it as a way of annexing land to the Israeli side, which is why it's being built through Palestinian agricultural land rather than the Green Line, or even along the edge of a settlement, for example.
Right. We're talking to Becca Wolf. Now, what is your own experience with settlers, with Israeli settlers?
Beit Omar, which is the town that I now live in, where my husband is from, and where our project, Palestine Solidarity Project, is based, is surrounded on five sides by settlements. And, you know, settlements range, the populations of settlements are not all the same. There are very large settlements that are considered secular settlements that are just cheap places to live near Jerusalem or near Tel Aviv. And generally speaking, while those settlements create serious problems for Palestinians because of land confiscation, because they're expanding, the residents themselves don't pose much of a problem. And then you have ideological settlements. Beit Omar is next to what is usually considered the most, or one of the most virulently right-wing extremist settlements, called Bat Ain. They are very famous for attempting to blow up a Arab girls' school in Jerusalem, an elementary school. They failed in blowing it up, but they attempted. And those are our neighbors. So what, I mean, my personal experience is that I've, one of the major kind of projects that we have is accompanying farmers to land that are near settlements that are in danger of being harassed or attacked by settlers. And there's a whole reason why, both political and also very tactical, why settlers attack Palestinian farmers. But often the presence of a foreigner will deter the settlers from attacking a Palestinian. But what is, you know, always really interesting to me is I have often told the settlers, you know, I can actually quote the Torah to them and debate them on what the interpretations of why this is their land or not their land, and which always sort of shocks them for a minute. And I'm always calling my sister up and asking for, you know, more ammunition.
Your sister, the rabbi.
My sister, the rabbi. Yes, I have to call her and say, can you give me an argument that I could interpret as this? And they are always a little bit shocked. I actually had a settler once who had just finished shooting at Palestinians, shooting at the ground in front of their feet, and I had run up with a camera and then started debating him with this stuff. He was from Brooklyn, so we were debating in English. And he said, you know, you can come and discuss Talmud with me any day, Talmud being like the scholarly books in Judaism. And so the disconnect, I mean, he really believed that part of his religious belief system included the need to rid the land of Arabs. I mean, so they have no qualms about attacking Palestinians, and there are no repercussions.
In order to do that, you really need to have in your mind an idea that some people are a lesser class of human or subhuman.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, for the religious Jewish settlers, the belief is that the Messiah comes when Israel is pure, and that also involves cleaning the land of Arabs. I mean, but they have no problem with saying that that's their intention. The Israeli government tries to sort of paint this in a different light or say that they're extremists, but that is the explicit motivation of a very large, very powerful sector of the Israeli population.
Did they not make a connection between their ideas of racial purity and the 1930s and 40s German ideas of racial purity?
One would think that they would. And certainly Palestinians are making the comparison. But it is very difficult to challenge Israelis and Jews, and particularly extremist ideological Jewish Israelis, on anything that's even smells like a comparison to fascism or Germany or any of these things, you can't talk about it.
But I mean, it's the same language. I mean, you know, dirty and clean.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, that is a tiny example in of all the different ways in which Israel has used and co-opted not only language but also policies of Nazi Germany. I mean, they and not only Nazi Germany, but it's certainly in their legal system of the British Mandate period, which the originally laws that were used against the new Jewish immigrants, they now use against Palestinian residents. And, you know, but we're not allowed to talk about it. And that's why the we're calling this talk Beyond the Rhetoric, because you're not allowed to talk about reality and facts of what people are really doing, because as soon as I bring up, if you bring up this issue of the language that they're using, it all could be painted or whitewashed as it's in defense of our security. Jews have the right to do absolutely anything to protect themselves, including, you know, right-wing fascist policies.
So we're talking to Becca Wolf, who will be speaking this Sunday, the 30th of January at 6 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation here in Santa Fe. What have you been doing, what is the Palestinian Solidarity Project doing to reach what, let's call them, you know, let's say moderate Jews in the United States and in Israel, who are basically decent, sympathetic people, which I would think would be a very huge number.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of a two-track program. On the one hand, we work a lot with Israeli groups inside Palestine, meaning that we bring people from a variety of different Jewish anti-occupation organizations and Israeli anti-occupation organizations, and work with them in Beit Omar. We've done joint women's projects. Actually, there's a quite well-known initiative that was begun by a group of Israeli women that wanted to smuggle Palestinian women into Israel and take them to the beach and then publicize it and say, we, these Israeli Jewish citizens and women, have done this in defiance of the laws of the checkpoints that divide the populations, and we've been really involved in that. So certainly working on the ground with Israelis. And then also in the United States, it's really an issue of education. We recently engaged in a bit of a discussion via email with some members of the synagogue, and it became really apparent that here in town, it became really apparent that people just actually don't know the facts. I mean, basic facts, not interpretations of facts or rights or beliefs or anything like that, but basic, what is the legal status of Palestinians? Who is in charge? Who is physically where? People in the United States, often, as you said, good-intentioned Jews, have absolutely no idea, and so fall back on whatever rhetoric they've heard most frequently or most, virulently, and that often is a very right-wing rhetoric here in the United States.
Why is there not more of a moderate or sympathetic Jewish voice in the United States?
It is building. For a long time, certainly also generationally, my generation, which is at least one generation removed, it's my grandparents that were affected by the Holocaust. And so I think that for the generation of Jews that of my parents' age, it was very difficult to talk about Israel in any way other than a savior of people. And it was incredibly emotional. It was very, very hard to differentiate between the belief of what Israel could be and what Israel was in reality. And I think that now younger people are starting to get it.
I think that when you think about what Israel could be in reality, it is a lot of those things. I mean, they have amazing, wonderful things going on in Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, it's very difficult to walk this line, because Israel's recent sort of hasbara, their propaganda position, or their program of propaganda in the United States, has been in order to counter all of the negative information that is being, you know, dispersed about Israel, it's to focus on the positives of what Israel has accomplished. And those aren't inaccurate.
Right.
Israel is a society that is highly educated, that has a lot of resources, that has a lot of innovation, that has a lot of, you know, artistic and cultural expression, and that's not to be denied. The different, you know, what we're trying to do is say that there is a difference between Judaism, Jewish culture, a Jewish ethnicity, a Jewish nationality, and Israel, the nation state, and Israel, the government. And those, you know, the Israeli citizens that are strongly anti-occupation and strongly pro-Palestinian rights and liberation are not Israeli.
Right. Now, you could probably say the same thing about Palestinians. The Palestinian people are not the Palestinian government.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're learning about that more and more, and hopefully
through WikiLeaks.
Yeah, exactly. Now the Palestine Papers.
Right. Now, you are married to another Palestinian, to a Palestinian. You're both activists. How did you meet, and how did you get together, and what's the nature of your work together?
We met in the summer of 2006. I went with a group of internationals that had sort of been sent to this town, Beit Omar, that had asked for an international presence because they were organizing demonstrations because a settlement was building a secondary fence around itself further onto privately owned Palestinian land. And one of the owners of that land was this guy named Musa, who was, you know, 28 at the time and was organizing the demonstrations there. And he was our contact person because he spoke a little bit of English. And we met, really honestly, we met because we went, I got to his village late at night. The next morning we went out to try to sit in front of the bulldozers, as they had been doing for the last few days. The soldiers that were present immediately tried to arrest him. And so all of these new activists, I was the only one who had ever been to Palestine before, were all trying to sort of negotiate with the soldiers and hold on to him so that they couldn't take him away and all of these things. And I ended up being the last one holding on, probably because I was a woman and all the other guys, you know, kind of got dragged away. And so I was trying to communicate in my broken Arabic while, like, lying on top of him on the ground, which is really inappropriate in Palestine, but apparently was acceptable if the soldiers are trying to arrest you. Everything's kosher.
So to speak.
Yeah, exactly. And so he ended up being arrested, but that was how we met. And
you met lying on top of each other.
Pretty much.
And then you got married.
And then we got married, exactly, which apparently, you know, it's Palestine, so that's obviously the only result that could have occurred. We got engaged, and then he was arrested and held in prison for...
So he got out, and then you got engaged, and then
right.
He went back in.
That's right. The first time he was arrested, he was only in for 9 days and was released, and we got engaged by the end of that summer. And we're trying to get all this paperwork in order, because you can be denied Israeli citizenship if you marry a Palestinian. So I was trying to get my citizenship before we got married.
Which
I did. But before we could be married, he was arrested and placed in administrative detention, which is a policy in Israel that's similar to Guantanamo Bay. It's a military tribunal, but all the evidence is secret, and the judge just issues an order based on whether or not he thinks the intelligence services have some case. And so he was held, it could be indefinite, it's just renewed over and over again, so he's held for 14 months. So we actually were married via the Red Cross, not face to face, but we technically were married.
Now, did that bond between you help him to get out?
It's possible. We were saying from the beginning, his lawyer was arguing from the beginning that what he was accused of was providing material support or some sort of support to a terrorist organization. It's really important for the American audience to know that all Palestinian political parties are considered terrorist organizations by Israel, including Fatah, who are the people that they negotiate with.
So if you were a member of Fatah, then you can be accused.
In theory, yeah, exactly. And so it was never specified what political party he was supposedly supporting, because all of that's secret. But so we had to sort of guess that maybe he was being accused of being an Islamist, and so we gave a bunch of evidence that he could not possibly be an Islamist. He's marrying a Jew. Hundreds of letters from Israeli activists saying in support of him were also presented to the judge. In the end, his detention was renewed 3 times before he was eventually released.
And now he's released, and the two of you are living in the occupied territories.
That's right. It's the only place right now that we can live together. So when I'm here, he has not been able to get a visa to the United States yet. So when I'm here, he's there.
And now you have an infant who can have multiple citizenships?
3 citizenships, 3. Yes. There's no such thing as Palestinian citizenship, but she can have an ID issued by the Palestinian Authority, and then also, yeah, Israeli and American. She can basically get into any country, anywhere, even if, you know,
right,
they're mad at somebody.
So tell us more about what the Palestinian Solidarity Project is up to.
We started as really a solidarity organization of international volunteers coming and supporting Palestinian popular resistance and also Palestinian attempts to really just remain on their land. So even really basic things like accompanying farmers when they work on land that's threatened with confiscation. And we've actually really expanded. One of the things that we quickly recognized was that there was also really a need for Palestinian grassroots organizing and support of network and creating a network of popular resistance, that it was too isolated by community. And so Palestine Solidarity Project, and now its sort of sister project, the Center for Freedom and Justice, has created a lot of different programs that are aimed at organizing Palestinians and also doing kind of leadership development and community organizing training for Palestinian youth. So the PSP and the Center for Freedom and Justice are really a unique organization. There's nothing else like it really operating inside the West Bank, in that it's both trying to address the issues of Palestinian self-sufficiency, Palestinian development, and community development, and Palestinian organizing, which is being run by Palestinians from the communities that they're trying to organize, and have this element of international solidarity and support.
Your Facebook picture shows you being dragged by Israeli soldiers. What was that incident? Is that the one you were talking about before?
No, that was an earlier incident. That was an incident in 2004 at a demonstration that was trying to also block construction of the wall in a village called Biddu. And yeah, that was painful. They couldn't decide which way they wanted to arrest me, so they're trying to pull me in both directions. But I've been arrested by the Israeli military relatively few times compared to other activists that have been around as long as I have. Part of that's because I'm a woman, and the Israeli military and their police forces are very reluctant, relatively speaking, to arrest women. But
does that give you an edge?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'd like to think that I use that to my full advantage. I mean, we know that, A, the military is very young. B, the people that are stationed as combat units or the border police who are really in charge of demonstrations are often the from lower socioeconomic class inside Israel. They're less educated, and so one of the byproducts of that is that while they're relatively reluctant or to attack or put any pressure on female participants, that's not to say that they never do, but it's certainly less than my husband, for example.
And they're probably less likely to want to injure an Israeli or a Jew than a Palestinian.
Absolutely. You know, the original idea of the international solidarity programs and the Israeli solidarity programs of going and participating in these demonstrations side by side with Palestinians was that it's not just a personal decision by the soldiers. There's actually military rules that designate that's say that there are different rules of engagement when there are Israelis and foreigners present than when there are not.
We're talking to Becca Wolf. Do those confrontations, do you think, have a different effect than other kinds of activism? In other words, that frontline confrontation, what good does it do?
You know, we really try to both understand the reality of the smallness of our actions and the but also to understand that so much of what Palestinian activism has been about historically, and also really any kind of liberation or civil rights struggle, has really been about motivating people to see that they are empowered. And so for us, when we talk to other Palestinians, Palestinian youth especially, about participating in these kinds of demonstrations, as opposed to, for example, throwing rocks in the street or doing nothing or engaging in armed resistance, which is non-existent right now, but you know, who knows in the future. What we're saying is that there is a certain level of dignity involved in being able to stand up to these sort of faceless soldiers and getting up close and saying, no, we really are going to insist on our rights to be here, and we're going to insist on them right now, that I think is actually quite empowering, because especially for this generation of Palestinians, they don't know anything about Israel or Jews other than a soldier and a settler on a hill.
And so at this point, the method of resistance, I mean, we hear about suicide bombers, but what you're talking about is unarmed, nonviolent resistance.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it has always existed in some form or another throughout all of Palestinians' various revolts and uprisings. There's always been an element of a popular mobilization, but especially when the Second Intifada started and the suicide bombing and the armed part of it, the people taking shooting at the military when they invaded, really isolated a large portion of the Palestinian population who didn't engage in it. So if you didn't have a gun, you were sitting at home under curfew. There was no way to, for women, for children, for people who didn't want to engage in armed activity, to participate. And so what happened when the movement, particularly around the wall, which started in 2003, while the armed resistance the suicide bombings and the armed militancy was still happening, was that there became a place for average Palestinians to re-engage in their struggle for their land and for their rights. And so that's what we're trying to just reproduce.
You said before that a lot of American Jews do not know the facts. Let me just give you an opportunity here before we go. What are a couple of the facts that you would like people to know?
Wow, I mean, it would be a a novel. I think it's really important to note that the issue of whether or not there are 4 million Palestinians who are denied basic political, civil, and human rights at the expense of an Israeli military is not up for debate. That is not an interpretation of what is happening. There are 4 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip who do not vote for who controls their military, the police force. They don't vote for laws. They do not have basic civil rights. They are,
because they're under Israeli law rather than their own.
They're under Israeli military law, yes. Military order. They're not even under, the
civil law.
Right. They're the Israeli civilians, the Israeli settlers who live next door to them in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, are ruled under Israeli civilian law. They don't. It's not specific to space. It's specific to identity, which is the definition of an apartheid state. And so, when people want to talk about comparisons between Israel and South Africa, to dismiss it is really to not understand the basic principles of what's going on there. And what I also hope that people can understand before beginning to get into sort of the debates of who is more desperate or who is more safe or who is more in need, to really remember that the principles of international law and the principles that including laws that Israel is a signatory to, the principles behind those laws are that it doesn't matter what group you are a citizen of or a member of, everybody is supposed to be entitled to basic human rights. You can't take those away just to ensure your life being easier or nicer or cleaner.
Becca Wolf is the co-founder of the Palestinian Solidarity Project, and once again, she will be giving a talk titled Beyond the Rhetoric, Realities of Israeli Occupation, this Sunday, the 30th of January at 6 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation, presented by Another Jewish Voice. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Lois Rudnick. She's a cultural historian. She's author of the book Katie Wells and Southwestern Modernism, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte.
Now, it's been a little over a year since the book about the artist Katie Wells came out, and spelled C-A-D-Y, so
Thank
that
you.
There's no confusion.
And he's a he.
And he's a he. He's a guy named Katie. And the book came out, and there was going to be an exhibition accompanying it that was delayed. Now there's three
yes.
Katie Wells art exhibitions.
Yes, which is wonderful.
And one of them is opening at the University of New Mexico Art Museum tomorrow, Friday the 28th of January at 5:30. It's called mm-hmm. Under the Skin of New Mexico, The Art of Katie Wells. There's also an exhibition that just opened at the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art here in Santa Fe called Collecting New Mexico, The Forgotten Katie Wells. And Aaron Payne Fine Art on East Marcy Street is also having an exhibition of Wells' work. So
yes.
We are awash.
We are awash in Wells.
In Wells.
Indeed.
So tell us a little bit about this artist and his work and these exhibitions.
Okay. Katie Wells, born Henry Katie Wells in 1904, grew up in Southbridge, Massachusetts. He was the son of a very prominent family that owned the largest optical company in the world, American Optical. Both he and his younger brother, Mason, were gay, not a sexual orientation that was preferred by this very conservative Republican business family.
Both brothers.
Yes, there were other brothers who weren't, but there were five children, and the two youngest brothers were both gay. Katie, as his brother put it, was the only family rebel who got to do what he wanted. That included dropping out of five boarding schools and dropping out of Harvard after one semester, which was not what he was supposed to have done. He loved art from a very young age. He painted when he went to boarding school in Arizona. The sort of his father's last gasp to turn him into a regular male was to send him to a boarding school where sex of all kind was rampant, so that really didn't work. But Katie fell in love with the Southwest, with the high desert, with mountains, and said, wrote in his diary and to his friends and in the early 20s, he knew his destiny was out here.
Interesting.
And tried a variety of things, and in 1930 took a tour of East Asia and ended up in New Mexico in the winter of 31, 32, and was invited to stay in Hakona in the Pojoaque Valley by E. Boyd Van Cleve, who would become one of his closest friends. And after a year here, after a few months here, he decided he wanted to choose painting as his vocation, not a choice his family had approved when he was younger. He was also trained as a classical pianist. And went to Andrew Dasburg and said, I want to study art. And Andrew looked at some of his work and said, well, come back in a year if you're serious. I think you're a dilettante. And so he went back east. He studied art history at the Fogg. He came back in 33. Dasburg looked at his work and said, all right, I'll take you on. 3 months later, he had his first exhibit at the Museum of New Mexico with Agnes Pelton and Raymond Johnson, and got great reviews. his studying with Dasburg that summer for 4 months was about the only formal training he got as an artist. He was predominantly self-taught. He was a watercolorist because he loved the spontaneity and freedom and expressiveness that watercolor allowed him. And in his early years here in the early 30s, his work looks a lot like Andrew Dasburg's watercolor, sort of cubist and a lot of expressive, wonderful landscape work with the landscape kind of exploding with color. A lot like John Marin's work that he did out here as well in 29 and 30. By the mid-30s, he has settled in the Pohake Valley. He has bought a home in Hakona. His good friend E. Boyd has become a mentor for him and inspired him to begin collecting santos and other Hispano-religious objects. By 1952, his collection was around 300 objects. He, in 51, actually decided to donate his collection to the Museum of New Mexico with two provisos. One, that they begin a Department of Spanish Colonial Art, which they had never had before, and two, that they hire E. Boyd, who was the foremost expert on Hispano-religious art, self-taught also, as their curator, and they did both. And as Robin Gavin says in the essay she wrote for my book on Wells's collection and its influence on his paintings, this donation was really the foundation of the first Spanish colonial art collection in the state. It's very important for New Mexico's cultural patrimony, and she has put together a show at the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art of much of it are the objects that he collected and donated. This tin work, the santos. She's even found the specific retablos and santos that he used as inspirations for his paintings, and the paintings are next to them, so you can see how different he was working with them, much more darkly and expressionistically than the santeros, who painted very serene, for the most part, created, carved and painted very serene looking saints. His saints are full of emotion and turmoil.
It's interesting to see the collection of an artist as opposed to the collection of an art collector who isn't an artist.
Exactly, exactly. And particularly an artist who paid enormously deep respect to the spirituality of particularly the Penitente tradition, without pretending that he was an insider or was speaking at all from, you know, an Hispano-Catholic voice. He was tremendously moved, I think, by the penitentes and by the santeros, particularly that were carved for them, because of the fact that they combine music and theater and ritual, because penance is a very important part of their sense of obligation. And he was a man who, I feel from reading his diaries and letters, never felt he could do enough penance for being born into privilege without earning it, and also because of the struggles he had with his sexual identity when his family did not want to deal with that or speak of it. And one of the reasons I think he came here was that this was a place where if you had money, you could be gay and independent and do as you wished without anybody really caring very much, as long as you weren't doing anything inappropriate in public. So it was a place he could be free, he could find his vocation as an artist, and he could also live as he wanted to as a man and an artist. And this is my, of course, interpretation of why he found this subject matter so fascinating. But his whole life he painted penitente moradas and penitente crosses and santos, who are deeply moving, deeply tragic. He was very drawn, I think, to the tragic history that was under the skin of New Mexico, as a friend of his put it. He said, "You're the only artist who ever got under the skin of New Mexico. You paint its tragic past."
And that's the name of the exhibition.
The name of the exhibition is Under the Skin of New Mexico, for the same reason. So he became, his work in the mid to late 30s became much darker, much more abstract and surrealistic. He joined the army in World War II at age 36 because he felt he owed his life to New Mexico and is finding himself to the state. This was his way of paying back. He spent the last 9 months of the war in mostly in Germany, seeing some horrific battles. He was an aerial topographer, which deeply affected his perspective after he came back from the war. His home was 12 miles from Los Alamos, and he came back to explosions on the Pajarito Plateau, which he surmised might be atomic, since nobody knew what was going on. They weren't, but his house literally, viscerally, he could feel the continuing atomic project, and he was appalled by it and painted some extraordinary, what I would call post-apocalyptic landscapes, believing that New Mexico would be ground zero for World War III because of what was going on at Los Alamos. No one was painting anything like this in the post-war period in New Mexico.
It's unusual to this day. I mean, painters romanticize
yes.
New Mexico.
I call him the not land of enchantment painter.
Yeah. So at the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art, we get a chance to look at the collection and some of the paintings themselves.
That were inspired by what he collected, yes.
And then at the University of New Mexico Art Museum, it's a comprehensive...
It is. It's a retrospective of his work from 1933 to 1953. It's the first retrospective exhibition of his work since 1967. So it's been well over 40 years since he's been given a show of his own. His work has been shown in group exhibitions, but no one has seen the corpus of his work. And I have to say, even though I'm the curator, so there's a certain amount of bias, I think that people who come to see this exhibition will be blown away by this work. That they, many people who live here don't know Katie Wells. Art historians certainly do. And the range and diversity of his technique and the depth of his technique and the power of his technique for a man who had essentially a 20-year career as a painter, because he died of a heart attack 10 days before his 50th birthday, is astonishing. So I'm really looking forward to the public's reaction to this body of work.
It's interesting that he has not been given his due until now.
Mm-hmm.
Was there, I mean, it's not, is it homophobia?
I don't think it has anything to do with his sexual orientation. I think it has to do with the way he paints New Mexico. There are two things.
The unromantic
thing. The unromantic view. His work is very dark, very disturbing. It's been interesting to see people respond to the work in Aaron Payne's gallery. The work that most people are interested in purchasing is his more traditional, more realistic, less frightening works, and the works that really appeal to me are the darker and the more violent and the more tragic, the better. I like all of his work, but I'm particularly drawn to that. The other, I think, reason has to do with the medium of watercolor, which in the kind of classification system of art value is much lower on the totem pole than oil, and he did paint a little bit in oil, because Georgia O'Keeffe pushed him to do it. He didn't really like painting in oil, but he was a watercolorist, and that's not a medium that has the same kind of, let's say, panache that oil painting does for most.
Now, he was in a whole community of artists and writers and so on, and one of his friends was Witter Binner.
Yes.
And there is a program coming up also at the UNM Art Museum on the 1st of February, next mm-hmm. week, Tuesday.
Yes, indeed. It's called Pieces of Cake, and it will be an adaptation by UNM theater professor Brian Herrera and five actors from the Albuquerque theater community of an absolutely hilarious and savage satire that Witter Binner, who was a poet and art collector who lived in Santa Fe, did of Mabel Dodge, art patroness Mabel Dodge Lujan from Taos. And it is, you don't have to really know that it's her. The play has a kind of timeless quality because it's really about the, you might say, obsessive-compulsive desire of wealthy Americans to consume the world's cultures. She has seven husbands. She has to be given a kind of treatment of mastodon ball soup every day to get her sexual energy up. She falls in love with men all over the world. She collects everything she possibly can. So I see it really as a very early play about American compulsive consumerism of exoticism. And Brian's adapting it, because it's a very long play, to a 50-minute reader's theater. So it should really be terrific fun.
And there's a whole lot more going on, and I guess if people want to find out about that,
they could go to the University of New Mexico Art Museum website.
And that website is unm.edu, and you can look for Art Muse. Well, Lois Rudnick is a cultural historian, and once again, her book is called Katie Wells and Southwestern Modernism, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. And people might want to pick that up and then, armed with those essays, go to some of these exhibitions.
Yes, indeed.
And once again, Collecting New Mexico, The Forgotten Katie Wells is at the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art. Aaron Payne Fine Art on East Marcy Street is holding an exhibition of Wells' work. And the UNM Art Museum opening is tomorrow, the 28th of January, at 5:30, Under the Skin of New Mexico, The Art of Katie Wells. Lois Rudnick, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.